So hello, welcome back to Slightly Fox, the podcast about lost and forgotten books, and thanks for being with us. This time, we're going to be discussing an extraordinary woman you may never have heard of, a 20th century writer whose vivid and unconventional life has just been brought to life in a new biography, and I'm delighted to say the author of that work will be with us today to tell us all about the fascinating Sybil Bedford. Slightly Fox editor Gail Perkis is joining us today, as is fellow Fox Stephanie Allen. My name is Philippa Lamb, and as I said, our guest today is a distinguished biographer, a great friend of Slightly Foxed, and an old friend of the podcast too, Selina Hastings. Hello, Selina.
Hello.
Now, Selina's written biographies of Nancy Mitford, Rosamund Lehman, and Evelyn Waugh, among others. It was Waugh we were discussing last time you were with us, I think, wasn't it, Selina?
Yes, we were with Alexander Waugh,
yes.
Discussing Brideshead and other subjects about his grandfather.
That was a really popular podcast. It went down a storm. Episode 18, is that right, Gail? I think it was,
yes,
wasn't it?
Yes, that's right.
As I say, I mean, you're here to talk about your latest subject. It's the European novelist Sybil Bedford. Now, she is not by any means such a well-known name, is she?
Oh, no, not at all. Although Waugh was a great admirer of hers.
Who is she? And why did you pick her?
I chose her because I had known her slightly. She was a great friend of an old friend of mine, a doctor called Patrick Woodcock. And I remember meeting her with him. And I then started to read her books and, of course, was fascinated. And so when, after she eventually died at a great age, I suddenly thought, what a wonderful it would be to write her life.
Now, obviously, we want to hear about the writing, but shall we start with her childhood? Because she did have an extraordinary childhood.
Yes, she did. I mean, it was a very unhappy childhood in many ways, although it was also rather comfortable and physically, in that her parents lived in a beautiful house in a small village in the west of Germany, and they had a small estate and servants, and they were very well looked after. And Sybil had everything she wanted except love from her parents, who were completely indifferent to her. And I think, of course, that sort of in a way damaged her and made her life very different from what it would have been had she been brought up as a beloved child.
Yes, because her father was a baron, wasn't he? But I think, am I right in saying he died when she was about 14?
Yes, he did. He did. By which time, Sybil's mother, who was very beautiful and very intelligent and very flighty, she had already left her husband and gone off with a series of lovers. And so after Sybil's father died, this time Sybil was about 14, she left Germany to join her mother first in Italy and then in the south of France.
And her mother was Lisa Bernhardt, as you say, very beautiful, but a very hard-living woman. She was a morphine addict, is that right?
Well, she did, at the end of her life, become a morphine addict. Yes, she did. But what she craved always was attention and admiration. And she had numbers of lovers. And of course, when eventually she started getting a little older, she began to get very worried and distressed about that. And that's when she started taking drugs.
So where did Sybil fit into all this? Did she have any sort of formal education?
She didn't have a formal education for quite some time. And then when she was 8, her parents suddenly realised that they must do something with her. And they sent her off to a local convent school. This is when they were living in Germany. And Sybil was, first of all, very taken aback, and then she was rather fascinated by it. And all went well until towards the end of the first day, they had a lesson in writing, and Sybil had never been told how to write.
She literally couldn't write?
She literally couldn't write. She could read, but she literally couldn't write.
That's amazing.
And so she felt totally humiliated, and one of the nuns sort of whisked her away and started giving her lessons. But as a result, Sybil's handwriting was totally illegible. And from a very early age, she started using a typewriter. And luckily for her biographer, she also used to use carbon papers as well. And so when her papers were finally sold to the University of Texas, and I went to look at them, not only were all letters to Sybil, because she kept everything, but huge numbers of letters from Sybil, because she had all the carbons.
What a wonderful treasure trove for you.
It was a treasure trove.
Both sides of the correspondence is the biographer's dream, isn't it?
It is, and very, very unusual to come across like that. After her father died, she then left to join her mother, who, unknown to Sybil by that time, had married a much younger man, Italian man, called Norberto Marcassani, always known as Norri. And with Norri and her mother Lisa, they travelled around Italy for some time, but it was at the time when fascism was rising and Sybil's mother didn't want anything to do with that. And so they then moved to the south of France, where they remained for years. And it was a sort of paradise for Sybil in many ways.
Was it? Why?
I mean, it was beautiful country and it was full of highly intelligent society.
And her mother would just leave her with various people, wouldn't she?
Well, she and her husband, Lisa and Norri, they bought a house, and Norri was always a real friend to Sybil. But it did all start to go wrong eventually when her mother started to drink and then became a morphine addict. And the people who then took Sybil up and became her sort of stand-in parents, as it were Aldous and Maria Huxley, who were living very nearby. And really, I think they saved her. They gave her sort of education and they were sort of stand-in parents for her.
Yes, I mean, this was a great meeting for her, wasn't it? Because Aldous Huxley, obviously a name everyone knows, Brave New World, Alice in Gaza. Presumably he wasn't that famous then, was he? He was an established writer? At what sort of stage of career was he?
No, he was an established writer, yes. And he was well known in the sort of Bloomsbury intellectual circles. It was Aldous's wife who realised what Sybil was going through, and she had been virtually abandoned in a sense by her mother. And it was Maria Huxley who then realised that she had to, in a sense, adopt Sybil. She also became her lover, by the way. But if it hadn't been for her, I don't know what would have happened.
So they were lovers at that early stage?
They became lovers quite early on, yes. I mean, Aldous was a tremendous womaniser. He never had any emotional contact with his lovers, but he liked sleeping with a lot of women. And Maria sort of helped it all happen and would be the one who sent the women presents and cooked them dinner and everything. And so that was fine. She also slept with one or two of Aldous's lovers. And so when she and Sybil eventually became lovers, it was, for Sybil, absolutely wonderful. I mean, it changed her life. She adored Maria, and Maria was everything to her. She was friend, mother, and lover.
So what age was Sybil at this stage?
Oh, in her late teens.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Maria is, what, about 20 years older, I think, isn't she? I mean, I must say, if we were looking at that today, we might have some questions in our mind about coercion and control, but you think it worked well for Sybil?
I think it worked very well for Sybil. And when her mother became out of her mind with morphine, it was Maria Huxley who arranged for her to be transported to Germany to a sort of convalescent home. Because by that time, Lisa's husband had left her. And, you know, what would have happened? Again, the Huxleys saved them. And then the next thing they did, as war approached, and Sybil was in a clearly dangerous position, being, first of all, a German in France, and secondly, Jewish, it was the Huxleys who got her to England and found what Aldous described as a bugger bridegroom for her.
Okay.
And that was Mr. Bedford, presumably.
And that was Mr. Bedford, Walter Bedford, who'd been working as a sort of hotel porter. He was gay, and they met for their wedding, and I think they went to the London Palladium that evening to see a show, and that was the end of it.
So a marriage of convenience in every sense.
Yeah, but that got her a passport, presumably.
Yes, it got her a British passport, and she became the very respectable-sounding Mrs. Walter Bedford.
There's a very splendid Desert Island Discs episode with Sybil Bedford, which was recorded in 1998, and she must have been very old by that stage.
This is BBC Radio 4 for people who don't know it.
Yes, and she talks very movingly about when her mother became a morphine addict, having to help her and having to buy drugs for her. And I mean, which for a teenage girl,
it was a terrible experience. She had to buy morphine from the local chemist to begin with, and then she had to actually inject her mother. And whereas at the beginning Lisa would have it once a day, then twice a day, and up to four times a day, and then the local chemist refused to go on selling it, so poor Sybil had to go along the coast from village to town, to chemist, desperately trying to get hold of these drugs. Aldous, who wasn't really aware of human emotions in a very normal way, he did write about Lisa and her drug addiction and the terrible scenes that he witnessed, and her lying in a filthy bed covered with old bits of food, and that appalled Sybil when she later read them.
It must have been horrendous. Sybil's in her teens at this stage, in her late teens when she's grappling with this.
Late teens, exactly.
Am I right in thinking, Selina, that she was sent to school in England at some point?
Yes, sort of. She was sent periodically to England by her mother, and she was lived with a very nice couple who had children, and they hired tutors for her from time to time. Mm. But what she did love was then she would wander about, go to galleries and stare longingly into the doors of expensive restaurants. And it was then that she met a German pair of sisters known as the Muir sisters. And they took up Sybil as a friend, and they introduced her to all the sort of literary world and took care of her in a way, which obviously her mother wasn't very interested in doing.
She said she had an education by example, didn't she?
Yes.
She followed the Huxleys, and her father
exactly.
had educated her in wine and food, which was, by the sounds of it, obsessed her for the rest of her life.
Yes.
I mean, was she writing at all herself at that stage, Lena? Or was this just, she was just surrounded by literary people and the possibility of writing?
Well, at first she was surrounded by literary people. Then she did start writing herself. And her model was Aldous Huxley. And she thought his novels were, you know, the greatest ever written. And she tried to imitate his style. And, of course, it didn't work at all. And she wrote three novels, none of which were ever published. And that so depressed her that she gave up for a long time. And it wasn't until after the war she spent in partly in the United States, and then after the war she spent some months in Mexico, and she wrote an absolutely wonderful book about her experiences in Mexico called A Visit to Don Ottavio. And that is what really started her literary career.
And what age is she then?
Well, she must have been in her early 30s then.
What on earth did she live off, Selina? I mean...
Well, that's a very good question. Because her father, he wasn't a rich man, but he was reasonably well off. And he left both Sybil and her sister enough money to live on. But of course, the moment the war broke out, that money was seized because the two of them were Jewish. And so she never had any money. And she lived off her friends, who were all incredibly generous. And I think she became entirely used to it. Maria Huxley used to give her money, and then most of her lovers were reasonably well off. And a number of friends were always writing her checks and paying her bills and so on. And it was something that in her later life, when she was earning quite a lot of money, people still went on doing because they sort of hadn't realised that anything had changed.
She might have told them, mightn't she, really? Tell us about the first book, Selina.
A Visit to Don Ottavio.
Yes, why would we want to read that now?
It was originally published under the title A Sudden View, and it was about her 8 months she spent in Mexico. Sybil had started an affair with a woman called Esther Murphy, who was quite well off. And Esther was a very, very heavy smoker and very heavy drinker, extremely intelligent. She was always about to write the great book about Louis XIV or Madame de Pompadour, whatever it is, so she never actually got round to it. She just talked about it. And it was she who took Sybil to Mexico. Esther wasn't remotely interested in Mexico, but they both were rather longing to get out of America. And so while Esther spent her days sitting and drinking, Sybil explored the country, and she was absolutely fascinated by it. And she wrote her account of the 8 months in Mexico. And it is extraordinary. It's unlike any other travel book I've ever come across.
What's unique about it, Selina?
It's just her very, very personal account. She was always obsessed with food and with wine, and so there's a great deal about that. But it's neither of them at that point had much money, and so they were travelling about the country on sort of crowded buses filled with pigs and hens. And then suddenly they find themselves staying at this incredibly beautiful hotel on a lake belonging to the Don Ottavio in the title of her book. He was a gay young man who absolutely extremely intellectual. Sybil thought he was wonderful. He knew everybody. She met them most interesting, fascinating people, many of whom she couldn't bear, and she was very open about the people she couldn't bear.
So it's very frank.
And it's just a charming, extremely personal, very, very observant account.
I mean, for what I've read, the actual act of writing did not come easily to her. She seems to have really hated it. I came across a quote, was it perhaps from her correspondence? The actual act as tearing, crushing, defeating agony, and filled her journal with all these despairing accounts of thinking, dawdling, dreaming, fiddling, ending always with an accusatory blank paper. I mean, we all know how that is. But she also didn't love it, but she really worked at it.
Yes, she did. I mean, she did find it very difficult. And she was lucky in that most of her girlfriends, not Esther Murphy, but some of the others, really, you know, put pressure on her to get down to work. And she wrote very, very, very slowly. And after all, she was brought up German, but her parents always preferred speaking French. But there she was writing in absolutely perfect English.
She said she suffered from sloth and love of life. Yes. Distracted her all
did.
The way through. Travel, food, wine.
Exactly. And she
love.
Loved, yes, there were her love affairs. She just loved life. And what she didn't love was sitting down to desk in front of a typewriter.
So why did she? I mean, because she felt a compulsion to write or?
Yes, because her mother had always, her mother was very, very well read. And very cultured. And it was she who really educated Sybil in that sense. And her mother always told Sybil that she, her mother, was going to be one of the greatest writers of Europe. And, you know, she was going to write the great novel that was going to change everything. But, of course, she never did. Mm. And I think that was part of what Sybil was influenced by, that she was determined she was not going to fail like her mother did, and she was going to become a writer.
I mean, she must have had nerves of steel to have survived.
Well,
that
yes
childhood.
And no. I mean, she suffered terribly from nerves, of all sorts of nerves. You know, taxi going to be late, plane's going to fall out of the sky, or the publisher's going to turn it down. But she was lucky that she had quite a large number of very literary friends. And I think because she was living in that world, that was a tremendous support to her.
You hear on Desert Island Discs, and obviously in her writing, she just had wonderful phraseology and such stories. Obviously her life was extraordinary. All of her books, her novels, they're all biographical.
Yes,
she, you
they
know
are.
The complexity of her character, she didn't really have to make anything up, did she?
No, I mean, what she was doing was writing about herself all the time. Mm.
Well, Selina, tell us about her next book, because that was autobiographical, wasn't it? A Legacy, which was published in 1956.
Yes, it was. When the First World War broke out, and she and her parents were living in this country estate on the western border of Germany and France. And they moved to Berlin to live with a Jewish family who was Sybil's father's first wife's family. Sybil's father, Maximilian, he married a young Jewish woman. Her family lived in Berlin. She died a few years after they were married, leaving him with a little daughter. Maximilian had no interest whatsoever in little daughters, so he left her with his parents-in-law, the Jewish family. They were very rich. And when he married again, he went back to live with them, taking Sybil, age 4, and his wife, and they went on supporting him. And Sybil was absolutely, even at the age of 4, she was extraordinarily beady and observant, was absolutely fascinated by this way of life that she'd never seen anything like it before. They were all so lazy and luxurious, and they had about 8 meals a day and dozens of servants, and nobody ever went for a walk or took any exercise. They just wallowed in luxury, and Sybil was fascinated by it. And she then discovered the stories also that lay behind her father's family history. Some of them were very upsetting, and that she also brought into Legacy. So it's not so much her own life, but what she observed and what she learned of her father's first wife's family.
And Evelyn Waugh thought it was spectacular, didn't he?
Yes, he did. When it came out, it sort of flopped, and Sybil's then lover, Esther Murphy, sent it to Nancy Mitford, and Nancy Mitford was absolutely enthralled by it, and she gave it to Evelyn Waugh. And he wrote a very appreciative review, and because it was, you know, by him, that caught everybody's attention and really started Sybil's literary career going.
But as you say, I mean, it didn't go down very well initially, did it? I think the London Times dismissed it as opaque, and her own American publisher pronounced it one of the dullest books he'd ever read.
No, it got very little attention, and what attention that it did attract was not very cheering, no.
But her third book, Jigsaw, wasn't published until a long time after that. So what did she do in between?
Oh, well, she wrote another couple of novels, neither of which were very good. The other great passion in her life was the law and legal system. And so she was taken to watch a trial at the Old Bailey when she was in her late teens, and she became absolutely fascinated by it. She would have loved to have been a barrister, but of course women couldn't in those days. So she wrote a wonderful, fascinating book, which is an account of one of the most famous trials that had ever been in this country, of a so-called murderer called Dr. Bodkin Adams, who had a large number of very rich elderly women patients, many of whom it was thought he had killed, and they all left him a great deal of money. And so this trial, which took place at the Old Bailey, was a sensation, and journalists came from all over the world to cover it. And Sybil was there every single day, and she wrote a brilliant account of it called The Best We Can Do. And it really started, I mean, that was one of the great passions of her life. It started, I mean, she did a number of others. She covered the Lady Chatterley case, she covered Stephen Ward trial, the Auschwitz trials. I mean, she was absolutely enthralled and fascinated by the whole legal world.
I was very interested in this aspect of her life, because it's quite different, isn't it? But it was a real passion, wasn't it?
Oh, a real passion, it really was.
The Auschwitz trial, which was the first trial by Germans of Germans, I think I'm right
yes.
in saying, wasn't it? Of 22 guards from the prison. I mean, that must have been, given that she herself had Jewish ancestry and,
yes.
and was German.
Yes, no, that was very, very harrowing. And she went for, I think she was there for the first week, and then it went on for a number of months, and then she was there the last few days. It wasn't a book, it was an article, but it was very, very good.
It's interesting that, I think it's fair to say, all her reportage was focused on crime and criminals and miscarriages of justice and censorship. I mean, she was campaigning journalism, wasn't it?
It was, in a way. Yes, it was. But she writes with such vividness and also understanding. It's not, you know, like just a report.
She feels like a woman with a cause about these things.
Yes. I mean, in a way, I wish she had been able to be a lawyer. I think she would have been, she probably would have become a great judge.
So all this time, Sybil is rotating round Europe, isn't she? She's in France, she's in Italy, Britain, of course, and Portugal.
Well, yes, I mean, she's endlessly on the move with various lovers. And every city she moved into, she would write to her friend saying, "This is the earthly paradise. I love it. It's wonderful. It's both the food and the people and the atmosphere." And then, you know, 2 years later, "I hate Rome. Ghastly place. Common people."
and during this period, she had a 20-year relationship with Edda Lord, who was an American novelist.
Yes, her three most important lovers were Esther Murphy, and she lived with Esther throughout the war, and then she went to Mexico with her, and then they came, eventually were able to come back to Europe, and Sybil assumed that she and Esther would settle in Paris or somewhere in France anyway. But Esther immediately then went off with another woman, and so Sybil was devastated and moved to Rome. And it was in Rome that she met the second great love of her life, Evelyn Gendel. And she was American and married to a very clever sort of diplomat called Milton Gendel. And she and Evelyn became lovers. They had to keep it undercover for a while, but Milton had never been very interested in his wife, so he wasn't particularly concerned when he discovered what was happening. And so he went off and led his own life, and Evelyn and Sybil lived together for a long time. And Evelyn was always a tremendous, tremendous support, really a wonderful friend of Sybil's, always. And then later in Sybil's life, her third great lover was called Edda Lord, also American. And Evelyn became a friend of Ida's. I mean, she behaved so well. And Ida and Sybil lived together in London and in France. And at the same time, Sybil was having dozens of brief affairs with other women. But those were her three great lovers.
Sybil remained friends with all her lovers, didn't she?
Yes, she did. Nearly all of them. Yes, she did. But I mean, and they were so good to her. And then she had a lot of friends too, who were not lovers, who also financially supported her. Martha Gellhorn was one who was extremely generous to her.
She must have been tremendous company.
Yes.
She seems to have drawn people to her. And maybe that doesn't come out when we hear about her life and how difficult she could be as well. Maybe that doesn't come out, but she must have been a wonderful raconteur.
Yes.
And she just had so many friends, didn't she, and so many supporters.
Yes, and so many worlds in which she moved. And she was so passionately interested in everything. And although she could sometimes be rather hard to understand because she had this little that sort of voice, she had an extraordinary memory and she was very perceptive and perspicacious.
It's probably worth saying that gay women had a much easier time of it than gay men in the decades we're talking about, didn't they? Because it wasn't actually, there was no illegality for them, was there, in the way
there wasn't. And as long as, you know, they kept it fairly discreet, and also nearly all of them were married, so that made them look very respectable. And they were really able to do as they like. You know, Sybil would go to a gay club in off the King's Road and pick up girls. They were careful not to speak of it outside their own world. But there was no, I mean, they weren't going to be in trouble. It wasn't like the awful law that the men had to deal with.
I mean, she claimed that her sexuality wasn't reflected or present in her writing. I think she was quite firm about that, wasn't she? But what do you think?
Well, there is one novel in which she describes a physical love affair between two women, but that's the only time. I think she wanted to keep it fairly private always. I mean, she wouldn't, at one point she was asked if she would, there was a very good literary agent in Paris, and that one of her friends or publishers said she ought to go to her, and she wouldn't because the woman, she said, was a lesbian, had a girlfriend, and she didn't want to be connected with that sort of thing.
That's an odd double standard, given the life that she led.
Maybe she felt she might be defined by it.
That could well be. Yes, that could well be.
Yes, I presume she did have a kind of vexed relationship with her own sexuality in some ways. I mean, as you say, love was hugely important to her for her whole life, as far as one can gather. I think people talk about her having lovers in her 80s and being in love in her 80s. I think Victoria Glendinning, the writer and critic, said she bumped into her at a party when she was 80 and she said she'd just fallen in love again. But as you say, I mean, it sounds to me, sorry, this cod psychology, as if there was some sort of tension there. That was her life, and yet it wasn't something that she really wished to associate with publicly.
I think she did have, particularly in London, she had quite a sort of glamorous social life that had absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with lesbianism, and she was very, very keen to keep that going. And
she compartmentalised her life.
Yes, compartmentalised it, exactly. But on the other hand, you know, right into her late 80s, she was having brief affairs with lots of women who were decades younger than she was.
It's amazing to me she had any time to write. The strings of lovers, I mean, it's time-consuming, you'd think, wouldn't you?
Well, yes. And I mean, how they fell for her, you know, this little tiny white-haired woman. But they did. I talked to a number of them.
She must have been really one of those genuinely magnetic personalities, because as Steph said, all her lovers, even the ones she left and treated quite badly by the sound of it, seemed to have felt fondly about her forever and helped her and assisted her. And that's a rare trait, isn't it, to be able to manage
that? It is. No, she obviously had an extraordinary sort of allure. But she was very, very highly sexed.
So does this bring us now to Jigsaw in 1989? Because this is her semi-autobiographical novel again, shortlisted for the Booker Prize. And it was a follow-up to a legacy, wasn't it?
Yes, it's a follow-up. It also repeats quite a lot about the early life of her father's first wife's family in Berlin. But then we also get, which is fascinating and very autobiographical, her then move to the south of France and her life there with the Huxleys and all the various other people she knew.
It's a frank account, is it, Celine?
It's a very frank account, yes, a very frank account. And it's impossible to see that it's a novel. It's an autobiography, which changes one or two names, but not many, and that is what happened.
But she also wrote a biography of Aldous Huxley herself, didn't she? A two
volume. Yes, she did, because she worshipped Huxley, and the biography is pretty terrible. First of all, she refused to read any of his letters, which I thought was a strange thing to do.
Odd choice for a biographer.
And then she just writes about him as it's a sort of deification. And the only time the book really comes to life is when she recalls her own relationship with the Huxleys. And then suddenly you're engaged and you see it all. It's not a good book.
Best to avoid it.
Yeah, absolutely, definitely avoid it.
Would it be fair to say that Sybil's writing is really vivid only when she's talking about the things seen through her own eyes? That is who she was as a writer. She couldn't really set herself into other people's situations or lives.
No, I think that's absolutely true. I think that's completely true.
So it's first-hand experience is what worked for her.
Yes, exactly. And she used them again and again and again. She used them very, very acutely.
Your biography, Selina, is subtitled An Appetite for Life, and that seems to me to encapsulate, you know, the essence of her, really.
Well, yes, she was. She was curious. She had, of course, sort of strange desire to be part of all her friends' lives, and she loved moving from one country to another, you know. She had great sense both of curiosity, and at the same time she was very, very, very observant.
And that comes across in Jigsaw. When I first read it, I thought it was wonderful. I'd never read anything quite like it, and that was possibly knowing that it was from life.
So, Steph, you've read these books. I haven't. You would recommend them to a modern reader. You think they're well worth the journey.
Yes, they're great for me, particularly Jigsaw. Both Visit to Don Ottavio and Jigsaw are published by Eland, and they still sell well and have quite a wide readership. Before coming on the programme, I had a quick look at Goodreads, that is a website where people can review books themselves.
Yeah.
And there are a number of recent reviews of Jigsaw, and people just find it sort of luminescent. It really is a glowing book. It's amazing that she writes it at the age of 78, and yet there's this real vibrancy of a young girl going through these extraordinary trials with her mother, but also making friends, watching them, going through experiences. It's a fabulous book. And one that, well, this life would not be possible now. I think she'd probably be taken away by social services.
One could only hope so. It sounds as if she should have been. But then, of course, we wouldn't have had the books, would we?
No.
So, Selina, can you tell us about her final years? Because she lived in London.
Yes. She lived in Chelsea. She had a tiny, horrible little sort of mouse hole of a flat, which she loved. And even when she was making quite a lot of money, you know, she never crossed her mind to move anywhere else. But it was also near a lot of her friends. And so, of course, her lovers had to live somewhere else because there just wasn't room for them to move in, except for her last lover, who was a wonderful, kind French lady called Aliette. And she did stay in the flat with her, but it was quite brave of her, I think.
Philippa, can I just bow out and go and shut the
dogs
up?
Yes,
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, you do that. We'll carry on if we may. I did just want to ask you, actually, Selina. I mean, I was struggling to get my head round Sybil, if I'm honest, because I think the writing sounds fascinating, but she's a difficult, snobbish woman who could, I think, be very unpleasant and waspish to people, couldn't she, when the mood took her? Yeah, obviously, you met her, as you say. You've really immersed yourself in her life and her writing. Do you like her?
That's a very difficult question to answer. I don't think I've ever written about people who were nice.
No, it's so true, of course. Evelyn Waugh, yes, not
Evelyn
Waugh,
Somerset Maugham, Nancy Mitford.
Yes, indeed.
None of them were nice. But I was endlessly fascinated by her. And I think if she'd been a really nice woman, she wouldn't have been so interesting.
And she seemed to be rather iconic in her circle. I've heard a few people who dealt with her who found her difficult, but nonetheless, even if they didn't maybe like her, they admired her. And
yes,
they were drawn to her because
exactly,
she was just such an extraordinary figure.
Well, I think I'm going to wrap this up actually by asking Selina that very question, really, which you, the point you make, Steph, and the point you made earlier, Selina, that you choose people who aren't really very likable, but are to write about. I'm intrigued to know what it is. Why do you choose these awkward folk?
Well, I think, first of all, it's their work. You know,
yes,
you can't write about someone who's work you think is terrible or it's not your sort of thing.
But they're quite akin to each other, Selina, aren't they, the ones you write about? They're a type.
Yes, yes. But I think it just makes it very much more interesting writing about difficult people. And I know when I was writing about war and Somerset Maugham and so on, the fact that they were so prickly and caused so much trouble was intriguing.
Selina, thank you. Such an interesting, well, introduction, I think, for me and for many others into Sybil Bedford. But, yeah, well worth exploring, I think, from everything you've told us. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Elegant, eclectic and entertaining, Slightly Fox is the literary quarterly for nonconformists. It introduces readers to all those wonderful books that languish on publishers' backlists but are often very hard to find in bookshops. Among its contributors are distinguished writers and novelists and people from other walks of life, all of whom share their passion for particular books and authors and write about them beautifully. Now, since it's entirely independent, Slightly Foxed is free to follow its own nose and celebrate the offbeat. So why not take out a subscription? £48 for an annual print subscription in the UK and Ireland, and £56 overseas. Your subscription also includes free access to all the back issues in the digital archive. Here's the web address, foxedquarterly.com, or if you'd rather talk to a human, give the office a ring on 020 7033 0258. Thank you. And now, Gail, you have another suggestion for a bookish day trip for us.
I do. So you have to go to the Baker Street tube station in central London, and you get out at Pinner, and a 10-minute walk through a little Victorian landscaped park will take you to the Heath Robinson Museum.
Aha.
So the museum was opened in 2016 by Michael Rosen, the children's laureate and poet and children's writer, and he opened it with a splendidly absurd gadget for cutting the ribbon. Heath Robinson was an illustrator and an artist, a landscape painter, but above all he was a cartoonist and a gentle satirist. And he has become famous, almost synonymous really, with unnecessarily complex and implausible contrivances. So anybody who creates a weird mechanised device, it's known as a Heath Robinson contraption.
Yeah, it was in our household, that's for sure.
Yeah. This little museum in the park houses a permanent collection of Heath Robinson's illustrations, paintings, and a lot of his cartoons and his commercial work for companies like Hovis. And it is full of the most glorious images. There's the patent electric egg poacher, a quick potato peeler, a wonderful machine for cleaning the holes on a golf course, which has an enormous sort of construction with an auger attached, which drills out the holes, a device for pulling a Christmas crackers. He had a glorious imagination. And there are also quite a lot of cartoons from the First World War where he satirised the horrors. There's one drawing of Allies in a trench, all laughing their heads off, and the Germans are attacking them not with chlorine gas, but with laughing gas. In addition to his cartoons, he was a book illustrator, so he did editions of Kipling and Shakespeare. And he also, in the 1930s, wrote a series of books called How to Live in a Flat, How to Make a Garden Grow, How to Be a Perfect Husband, and all of these are illustrated by him and with his wonderfully idiosyncratic view of life. It's charming, and there's a very good little shop, a changing exhibition, and then there's a very good cafe as well. So as a day out, I really recommend it.
When life feels too serious, it feels like the place to go, Gail.
And if you want to read more about Heath Robinson, Adam Hart Davis wrote a book called Very Heath Robinson, which was published by Sheldrake Press.
Book recommendations, please. Steph, can I start with you?
There's an author I've been meaning to read for a number of years called Italo Calvino. I'm sort of working through translations.
Yes, we're noticing the pattern over the period of the podcast.
So there are a number of books he's very well known for, Invisible Cities and If on a Winter's Night a Traveller. But I thought I'd start with Marco Valdo, which is subtitled The Seasons in the City. It's a collection of 20 stories. They feature Marco Valdo, who is an unskilled labourer working in a factory, but he has romantic dreams. He has a life of drudgery. He lives in a two-bedroom flat with his wife and six children. But in everyday life, he sees something of wonder wherever he goes. And he has these schemes to better his life. He's going into work one day, he's at the bus stop, and he sees these little mushrooms coming up through the paving stones. And he has a plan to harvest these mushrooms and feed his family. They do harvest the mushrooms, but unfortunately they're poisonous. They don't prove fatal, but they do put his family in hospital.
Ooh.
And every single story sort of follows that theme. Some of the stories are a little more whimsical than others, and you could call them sort of magic realism. But they're wonderful. He's a daydreamer, but there's a serious side as well. They have themes of pollution and corruption and the fact that most people would like a slightly better life and that nature can come into day-to-day life and brighten it. And they were read on Radio 4. Toby Jones dramatised them and Mackenzie Crook read them. And they're in a similar vein to the television programme that those two have become most famous for, which is The Detectorists. It's a simple, gentle way of life where they are looking for some sort of day-to-day escapism.
Yeah, you describe them very beguilingly. The name again, Steph?
Marco Valdo, and the novelist is Italo Calvino.
Thank you. I'm not going to bother Selena with a request because we've made her do enough talking. So, Gail, what do you have for us?
I've just finished the second novel by Francis Spufford called Light Perpetual, which was published this year. He is the most wonderful writer, and this book is a fantastic feat of imagination. He teaches at Goldsmiths College in London, and every day when he goes to work, he goes past the site of a department of Woolworths which was flattened by a V2 rocket in November 1944. 158 people died, including 15 children, and he uses this as the starting point. And then he winds the clock back, and the rest of the book is him imagining what five of these children, what lives they might have had, had the bomb not exploded. So we start off in 1949, and they're all in primary school. Then he moves to the mid-60s, then to 1979, and into the 90s, and on into 2009. And these five children all have very different lives. The clever one, Alec, becomes a compositor at the Times and is involved in the union strike in 1979. Another of the boys becomes a bus conductor and has schizophrenia. The third boy becomes a property developer and follows the sort of booms and busts in London. So the lives are messy and they're quirky and they're full of jokes and obstacles and blessings. And in each section, he evokes the period brilliantly. I mean, he describes how hot metal typesetting takes place and the smell of the lead. He describes the process of gentrification in South London. It's a hymn to life in all its variety, and it's beautifully written. I can't recommend it enough.
He's an exceptional writer, isn't he, as you
well,
say?
Of course, we had him on a podcast.
We did, yes, and yeah, which was a great joy.
On children's books.
I think we haven't really talked about his first book, which was it Golden Hill?
Golden Hill, which was about an English chancer in 18th century Manhattan.
Yeah, and as you say, the description of the environment and New York in its fledgling days was almost beyond anything I've ever read.
Yes, well, this is the same. I mean, he conjures up, in 1949, he conjures up one of the boys gets taken by his father to a football match, and it's Millwall, which anybody living in London knows the reputation that Millwall supporters have.
Rowdy would be a polite way of putting it. Yeah.
Well, a very polite way of putting it. it's a fantastic feat of imagination.
A rare talent. Yes, a great recommendation. Indeed. Thanks, Gail. I haven't read that yet. It's a treat in store for me. and we're done, I think, for this month, at least. Many thanks, Selena. Thanks so much for being with us again.
Well, thank you.
You'll find all the books and writers we mentioned in the show notes. We'd be very grateful if you could rate, review and share the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, more people who get to hear about it, the better. Until next month, thank you very much for listening and for joining us on another literary trek off the beaten track.